Well, it is about quarter after, so it's time to begin. And the tape, I'm assuming the tape is on because that thing was recording on the computer at least here. I'm John Marty, and the state senator from Minnesota, and I'm going to talk today about the loss of our society's vision. The title I've given for this was, Where's Our Society's Vision? Overcoming the Defeatist Attitude in America, in American Politics. And my main qualification for talking about this is 22 years of watching politicians in our political process accept things that I think we should consider unacceptable, and 22 years of watching them do so without providing any vision of the way things can be. Enjoy the cool in here. America has always had a can-do attitude. We believe we can accomplish great things as a nation. We've always been proud of what we can do. We had the belief, for good or for ill, that our ingenuity and our hard work could make life better, and there was no challenge we couldn't accomplish. It goes back to settling the frontier, for good or for ill, we could take over the continent. World War II, we defeated fascism and saved the world for democracy. Kennedy said we could put a person on the moon within the decade, and we did. But sometime along the way, we've been falling away from that. The American dream, where every parent wants to make life better for their kids, the next generation, than for their own, presumably meaning economic ways and non-economic ways. You wanted life to be better. Well, at least in economic ways, and I would argue in other ways as well, that's a thing of the past. People are talking, you know, I wish my kids would have the secure retirement that I know I'm going to have. I wish they would have the same chance to guarantee that they were going to have health care that our generation had. But we've slipped away from that, and I think people recognize that most people say, I'm worried about the future for my kids. I'm not as confident they're going to do as well as we can. And it's become very much defeatist. Problems have become too big or too complex or too expensive to solve, and we just have lost confidence that our government or our society in general can address those problems. I'll give a couple of examples. Healthcare. The healthcare system is in crisis. Something like a third of all Americans, like 1 in 10, 1 in 8 or 9 Americans, doesn't have any health insurance. And another good chunk, probably a third of all Americans, can't afford to get all the medical care they need when they need it. They can't afford prescriptions, they can't afford dental care, they can't afford chemical dependency treatment, they can't afford whatever. And it used to be, well, we can fix that problem. We can provide health care for all, but that's not where we think anymore. It's just too complex, it's too expensive, there's no way we could do it. Same thing with poverty. Ending poverty, well, be a nice thought, but we can't really do that. It's not really hopeful, not much chance of actually doing that. And I'd like to make the argument that while we can fix, while we can't make things perfect, providing health care to everyone isn't going to make our health care system perfect. We can still do better than we do now. It's not a Pollyanna-ish, things are going to be great, but nevertheless, we can tackle a fundamental problem. I was on a healthcare access commission our legislature created a year and a half ago, and all last year we met many times, and our task was to the chairs who put together the task for the commission gave it a task of making recommendations on how we could provide healthcare for every Minnesotan to have a full range of healthcare services by the year 2011. Well, oopsies about how we could provide health care to everybody by 2011. But the commission meets and they have no intention of doing that. They started with basically tinkering with the system we have. They said they had one of the subcommittees of this commission was going to look at how we can provide nursing home employees with health care benefits. That's a pretty narrow slice when you're looking at supposedly providing it for everyone. And in the end, they didn't even accomplish that. Instead, they recommended spending, can't figure out how you could spend it much, but $800,000 to study how we could afford to provide health care. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'd be a big chunk of the way there. But the whole idea. We couldn't accomplish it. And I suggested at the first meeting, why don't we start with what our task is? We are supposed to make recommendations on how every Minnesotan has access, every, not 93% where we are now, not 98%, but 100% has access. And they have access to a full range of healthcare services, not just basic benefits, but dental care, which is just as important as a lot of other parts of our body. That they could afford the prescriptions, they could afford the medical supplies they need. Why don't we start there and work backwards from there? If that's our task, let's figure out, okay, everybody in, this is Minnesota, everybody here is going to have access to go to the doctor, the dentist, the chiropractor, the care they need when they need it. And then we'll figure out how we're going to do it working back from that goal. Everybody just kind of stood there and no response. So I said, let me answer why I don't think this commission is going to do that. It's because we know how expensive the healthcare system is now and how complicated it is now. If we're going to cover more people, we're going to cover more people for more things, of course it's going to just absolutely bankrupt the whole system. But realistically, well, first of all, it's not rocket science to fix that. When I said earlier, Kennedy said we were going to put a person on the moon within the decade, that was rocket science. And that was a challenge because I don't know how high previous rocket flights had gone, but I'm thinking 100 miles was above the planet's surface is the furthest we'd ever gone. And at that time, we're talking, we're going to send somebody a quarter million miles away and back. That was amazing stuff. But in terms of healthcare for everyone, people have done that before. We're the only industrialized Western nation that doesn't provide healthcare for everyone. And PBS did a, Frontline did a series in which they interviewed people in five different countries about 2 or 3 months ago. Every one of those, they asked the healthcare expert in each of the countries, including Taiwan, which is, I think, a more second world instead of first world industrialized nations. They're a developing nation that's making progress. Are you Taiwanese? They've got one of the best healthcare systems in the world now. They took a look at what other countries have done, and they thought, let's put together the best of the best, and they did it. England, Japan, they looked at five different countries, and it was pretty impressive. Every one of them was able to do it, and we say, we're the can-do nation. We're the nation that's got the skill and the brain power and everything to do that. But we haven't been able to do that. So when did we start getting this attitude of defeatism? Certainly, there have always been, throughout history, in every country, everywhere, there's always two sides on every issue. One side is, well, we could never tackle that problem, or the side that says, yeah, we can accomplish it. But in the 1960s, we actually called it a war on poverty, and poverty won. We surrendered that war sometime in the 60s because we could never fix the problem. We couldn't address it. We could make poverty less miserable for people, maybe. We could help some of the people in poverty. Maybe we could reduce the poverty rate, but there's no way we could end poverty. Now, four decades later, we're at a stage where we find acceptable, and Minnesota, I think, is a wealthier than average state. Our state income per household is significantly higher than the national average. And yet we have in Minnesota a lot of working people who go to their job by day, they go to a homeless shelter by night because they don't have any place else to live. I met a woman in Duluth who she and her husband both worked two jobs, and they were living temporarily, of course, but they were living in a homeless shelter. We have people where you have working parents who can't afford health care. We have, in Minnesota, we have bridges that collapse on us. We can't afford to take care of our own infrastructure. And I think I told on Monday a story that when I'm on a commission to end poverty in Minnesota that the legislature created, and we were touring northern Minnesota, a number of tours to find out what poverty was like. And I met a woman, very impressive woman. She and her husband, I don't know what all they did. They farmed a bunch of other things, but they had adopted a number of kids. And between foster kids and adopted kids, they had probably 20 kids that they either had raised or were in the process of raising. Most of them were special needs kids. Some of them fetal alcohol syndrome babies who developmentally disabled, a whole range of disabilities. And she said that as they become teenagers, and most of them were at the teenage years when we met with them last year, she said they're working to try and teach these kids to be happy living in poverty, because she said that there's no realistic way that they're ever going to earn enough money to bring themselves out of poverty. So they will spend their entire lives in poverty. That really hit me. We're saying this is, we're telling kids, you know, be happy in poverty because that's all you're ever going to have a chance for. Where did we come to this? How did we get it where we're the only Western industrialized country that doesn't provide health care to people? Well, I would attribute it into the in the political world where I'm dealing with, attribute to some people don't care. You know, wait, you know, most people, go buy your own health insurance. If you don't have health care, go take care of it. Some people just, that's not an issue for them, they don't care. Some politicians, without any evidence, claim that, you know, if government would get out of the way, the problem would take care of itself. Well, that's, there's no evidence that that happens, and it never has worked that way. The market works for people who have money. It works for people who are able to get money, but there are plenty of people who are under our market are working many hours a week, and 40 hours a week at minimum wage is not anywhere near enough to be able to afford health insurance. So some of them claim we can do it if government just does nothing. Others claim that, oh, we really want universal health care. That commission that was created to provide health care for everyone in Minnesota 2 years ago was done. Well, of course, we've got a goal of this. But when you look at it, well, we don't really think we can get there. We're just saying that because we want you to know we really would like that. Well, yeah, we all like motherhood and apple pie, too, but it doesn't mean saying it is enough. Rhetoric doesn't do it. And so that group of politicians goes, well, you know, we'll at least make life better for some of these folks. But maybe we can give farmers or nursing home employees, we can get them health care coverage. Maybe we can do something to help make a little better access to dental care to low-income people in greater Minnesota where it's almost impossible to find. But most politicians of both parties, of whatever political philosophy, are either in the camp they don't care, or government doesn't have any role in this, or government can't really do it, and therefore we're going to have to accept these situations, people who are homeless while they're working, etc. And not only do we accept that unacceptable, we also expect it to get worse. The demographics of an aging population point to the fact that we can have higher health care expenses, higher social service expenses for people who don't have sufficient retirement income, and higher education. Minnesota is not alone, though we're one of the worst states in terms of higher education expenses. You talk to people my generation, and they talk about coming out of college with a few thousand dollars in debt, if that, and you know, summer jobs help pay for most of it, and you talk the generation before that, and tuition, University of Minnesota might have been $200 per term. Now you have kids who are graduating with $20,000-$30,000 in debt and not any chance of a job that's going to pay them a lot. And we expect it to get worse. Every year we talk about we're going to do something about tuition and higher education. Every year the funding that, speaking from my state, that we provide for higher education is enough that University of Minnesota and our state colleges and universities, tuition is going much faster than inflation. And financial aid is not going along with it. So we expect it to get worse. How did we get to this situation? Well, I have the belief that it's not economic. During the Great Depression, we had schools functioning. I actually tell a story of a former Minnesota public official who talks about his father who was a poor family and he couldn't afford a lot, and he was in school band in North Minneapolis in high school, and the school provided him with an instrument for free because he couldn't do it. Now you can rent them if you don't afford your own instrument, but they provided him with an instrument because he couldn't afford rent or anything. They provided him with music lessons because he couldn't afford it. There's no chance in the world. I don't think there's a school in Minnesota that would provide free music lessons and free instruments for kids to use. And he said, and that was during the Great Depression. And you think, our country was broke then. And then we not only funded our schools then, but we built a lot of our infrastructure. Aren't many people still alive who worked in WPA, Works Progress Administration, or Civilian Conservation Corps? But so many of our national parks and our state parks and roads and bridges were constructed at that time. largely by hand labor, but our nation was able to do that. That's how we pulled ourselves out of a depression, but we made those commitments to address those issues during the depression. Now we have an economy that's booming for most people. This watch works good most of the time, but slowed down the day I got here, and I thought, uh-oh, the battery's dying. But it was a $25 watch, maybe somewhere in that range. I don't remember. It's old enough, I don't remember. But I looked online, because I used this in a talk last week, and checked, and you can buy a beautiful Rolex watch, looks a little different than this, for $57,000. And if you want to do it without the jewels, because that one had diamonds and stuff on it, if you want to have the simple one, I think it's the same mechanism, it was only $19,900. Almost 1,000 times as much as this watch. Somebody is buying it. If they're selling it, I'll guarantee you somebody's buying it. Somebody has the money for that. And look at the stores right before the Christmas season, or the advertisements. The gift for somebody who has everything. What are we trying to do? We're trying to find a way to spend our money. Somebody, well, I don't know what to get them. They already have everything. We actually don't flinch at that. Is that the way we show our love for others? Is that the way we celebrate Christ's birth? Is by trying to find a way to spend money on somebody who doesn't need anything. Our society does have resources. We don't lack resources. It might be a question of who has them and the priorities we set, but it's not a lack of resources. If it's not resources, why are we in a situation where we can't tackle problems? Where's the lack of vision? What happened to it? Well, I'll again divide this up politically because that's the realm I work in. There are a lot of people, I will classify them, they're not all Republicans, I would guess they're all conservative, but there's a group of politicians and media and others who go along with it. Government is evil. Government is inefficient and incompetent. Government has no way of solving problems, and if we spend more money on, you name it, education or healthcare or whatever, it's a bottomless pit. It's not going to do any good. We're just throwing more money, good money after bad. And these same politicians, even when they are in control of the government, are bashing the government. They're trying to make government look bad and show it's incompetent and a failure, which is a strange thing to do when you're in charge. You think it might backfire. Maybe you're running the government poorly. Maybe you're doing something corrupt. Maybe you're doing something that's misguided. But instead of it backfiring on them as being bad managers, they keep saying it's government that's inherently bad, inherently troubled, inherently unable to fix problems. Though other countries are able to do it, they can't do it here. And this government is a failure, government is bad, is facilitated sometimes by even businesses that are making money hand over fist off of the government. When Halliburton got its contracts, they weren't competitive bids, but contracts to rebuild in Iraq. They now say, and I can never figure out how they can claim this is the case, but the number of news reports that close to $1 billion is unaccounted for, where it went. It's not like that I balance my checkbook and there's a little bit of money missing. I don't know how I added something wrong. They've got accountants and bookkeepers, and somehow we lose money. And that's the one side. Let me label the other side as progressive Democrats. And again, it's not all Democrats and it's not all progressive, but this is the other side. And their response to the government is evil, troubled, unable to accomplish things, is that not to offer any clear alternative. There might be some good rhetoric, oh, we want universal health care, but they don't offer proposals to address that. They don't even try. There's no proposal out there saying, here's how I would get universal health care. It's kind of, well, let's have a study commission, and that's their job, and well, you know, it's really complex, and we can't really do that. Along with that, the good rhetoric, but no policies to do it. There's no vision, never spelling out what the vision ought to be. And I think a lot of this is driven, truly driven by the fact that they don't think it's politically feasible. It's not realistic. That, to me, is the number one reason they say that, because they really themselves do not believe they can make any progress or we as a society can move forward. So what's the public reaction? I hear one side say government's a failure, the other side say, well, you know, we'd really like to do something, but no, you got to be realistic. People believe what they're told. If they hear it from Republicans and Democrats alike, that's the way it's going to be. They never hear a positive vision. They never hear the way things could be, so they get the message problems aren't fixable, and if we are going to spend more money on healthcare, it's throwing more good money after bad. We've lost the will to try. I guess before going on, I'm wondering if I've mentioned from a partisan point of view how one side is saying government is gonna fail. Katrina, I mean, I think was a perfect example. A lot of people died in that, and there were a lot of preparations that could have been made fairly simply. We just didn't do it. That was, Republicans seem to be saying that, and Democrats are saying it was the Republicans' fault and we would do better, but not really offering proposals on how to make it better. I wonder if people have other thoughts, things that I'm not mentioning, that on why we've come up to this. Why do people think, if you agree with the premise, that we really don't feel as a society we can tackle our problems, or other things?
From a personal standpoint, one of the big frustrations is the view that, and I think this, and it may not be entirely justified, but I think it is, that some statewide as well as our national politicians are either partially or wholly owned subsidiary of the business interests. You mentioned Halliburton. You know, that one is, we have Dick Cheney, who was the CEO prior to his election as vice president, and that corporation has been getting these ridiculous no bid contracts. We talked briefly about in a previous session how the pharmaceutical industries have basically bought the votes necessary to pass the prescription drug bill, as well as the Minnesota legislature. For years, having turned down public financing for a stadium, all of a sudden decided that this was the thing that they should do. And
it's in other words, it's the government is bought off, or it's corrupted somehow. They're too tight with interest.
Yes, and this is of course nothing new. It's been going on ever since they were rich and poor.
Right.
You know, like one quote out of a book that I read that was published in the 1920s was that if Wall Street wanted something at 10 in the morning, Congress was voting on it at two in the afternoon. And yeah, the thing is, this may be somewhat cynical, but there's unfortunately a lot of truth to it.
Yeah. So a lot of belief that the system is the problem with the system. It's not the government couldn't do it, but our government is set up in such a way it's corrupted by, because as you mentioned, that's been going on since the beginning of
history.
Even then, I mean, 1920s, I think we felt we could do more as a country than we do now. But that is a contributing factor.
The lobbyist's role then, partly is part of his story there, isn't it? The terrific influence that they have, and the money that they give in order to get reelected and get the favor of the people. Is that
That's,
one of the issues?
I think it's a big problem. I gave a talk about it yesterday, and I mentioned a New Jersey real estate developer in 2006 gave something like $89,000 to Minnesota politician, New Jersey developer. $20,000 to the Democratic Party, $20,000 Republican Party, $6,000 to the Republican House Caucus, $5,000 to the Democratic House Caucus, money to $5,000 each Democrat and Republican candidate for governor. All this money, he's sort of equally split. Why is he doing this? Well, he's the owner of the Minnesota Vikings. He's asking for half a billion dollar stadium with public money. And he is likely to get it in time, because he's persistent and he's got the money, and so I don't disagree, and I recognize it, but you're saying that's one of the reasons you think a lot of people believe they've kind of lost hope.
You can boil it down to something very simple: private deals with public money.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
My belief is that we are a society of 300 million individuals, of 300 million corporations, each concerned with ourselves. The vast majority, I think, we're not congealed. We don't have a common sense like we did 50, 80 years ago, or 150 years ago. We seem to be concerned with what we want.
What's good for me. Look out for number one.
Right,
look out for
right.
me. Yeah, I
just extreme Americans are very individualistic, to a great extreme degree. That probably does.
It's our tradition, yeah.
Yeah, that's just part of the psychological history.
Right.
Is it more so than during the Depression? It'd be interesting, and if it is, why?
Well, I think it is more so, and I think it's a really good point. My premise would be that during the last 20, 30 years, 30, 40 years, we're just, I hope, coming out of a political era which was very heavy on appeals to fear and personal self-interest, greed, and what's in it for me. I think of until the Great Society programs in the 1960s, that the example I like to give is in Minnesota, using Hubert Humphrey, who was, until the 1960s, was a guy who had first proposed the Peace Corps, Food for Peace program, food stamp, a whole range of things he had been the one to initiate. And he would tell people, especially in Minnesota, but when he was running for president, when he was vice president, he'd say, by golly, we Americans care about our senior citizens. We want to make sure we treat them right. And people would say, yeah, we are good people. We do care about our senior citizens, and we want to treat them right. You appeal to somebody's generosity, and we all have some of that in us. And then 20 years later, it became, who can better spend your money? You or those guys in government who want to take your money away from you? And people, yeah, you know, why should they take my hard-earned money away from me? And so people believe that. So I think it's partly been the political appeals have been to that. I think appeals to generosity in people, even in the last couple decades, worked, but they were very seldom made, and most of the appeals were look out for number one and nobody responding to it.
You know, this all about the money kind of mentality that has captured our psyche here, I find that the election process has become so almost fatally flawed. Because now not only do you have to worry about the government spending your money rather than you, but you have to worry about candidates spending your money just to get elected so they can spend your money instead of you.
Yeah.
And you know, it seems to me that unless that process is completely reformed, when we don't spend 2 years running for re-election, which means senators or congressmen rather have to not get elected, they have to run for re-election immediately.
Been struck by some of the ads in the health field on television, which at the end of it, they suggest that if you use this product, you can get better, and you don't have to change the way you live at all.
Yeah.
And I wonder how...
Don't worry about your weight and so on, just take these pills.
Exactly. If there's a broader application of that sort of psychology at work for us in this country, especially in this country, where we have been highly successful, and you say we do have resources, we can do a lot, and there's a sense that we really don't have to change our priorities.
We deserve what we have.
And we deserve more. And these problems can somehow be solved without our having to do anything different.
I think there's all these points add to it. And one more related to that, we tend to think that, yeah, we deserve everything we got, and the next guy over is not. I did a talk on poverty earlier in the week, and remember a guy who I had gone campaigning door to door, and came to this guy in a nice townhome complex that's public housing, and the guy, I talked to this one guy and left, and a few minutes later he came down the street to catch me, and he just thought of something he had to talk to me about, and it was about what welfare cheating, welfare waste. And I said, you mean like public housing? Oh, no, not like public housing. He then mentioned another program that was pretty clear he was benefiting from it. No, not like that. And so what did he mean? Well, he meant like those neighbors of his, all the things they were getting. And he did not see in himself, he honestly did not believe he was a recipient of any public money, of any government, whatever. And we see letters to the editor and papers once in a while from somebody who, I worked hard for everything I have, and all government does is take all my money away. And often there will be somebody who writes a letter back saying, well, where'd you go to school? Whose roads you drive on? Who made sure the airplanes you fly are safe? Who did this and things government does? But again, it is that I deserve what I have. Of course, every generation we've had more, And so we deserve what we have, and if somebody's trying to take it away, they're taking away my stuff for somebody else. But it all leads to, I don't know, you haven't back raised that, the individualism thing that we're separate from. Couple with that, we'll move on. So go ahead. We got three more, yeah.
Oh,
go ahead.
Okay. Another point, and this goes back, you know, you can raise this argument over and over again, but some people say, well, if we hadn't spent $500 billion or $1 trillion, whatever number you want to use, on the war in Iraq, we could have used that money. That's not, well, then it was, well, if we hadn't built this missile defense system, we could have used that money to, well, if we hadn't spent all this money in Vietnam, we could have used that money to, but we wouldn't have.
You're right. I mean,
yeah.
We've had the same thing when I was suggesting, when I was fighting against some of these stadium subsidies in Minnesota, I kept saying, we can't even make sure kids have the right, decent textbooks in the schools, but we're able to do this. We didn't fund it in the last 10 years, and we still didn't fund the schools, so it's not either or. Well, it is either or, but when we have the resources, we won't spend them that way. It's a really good point. Yeah. They realize government isn't going to, but yeah, if we spend, it's going to be a couple of $1 trillion on the war when you count the lifetime costs of the people returning. That's a phenomenal amount of money, but we can't fathom it.
We could have ended poverty.
Yeah, we could address a whole lot of it. So it's a legitimate issue. The point is, yeah, if we weren't in the war, would we have fixed it? No, we can't afford to.
There is tremendous pressure from big business interests to do things like go to war. I also found it interesting that the man who at least made the phrase military-industrial complex famous was made in the farewell address by Dwight David Eisenhower.
Right, right. And that's really happened. I mean, the more successful, more profitable war becomes, the more there's the industrial complex.
Well, I mean, a couple of thoughts, and I agree with everything everybody said. I guess I would add to this. I think there's also an issue, and to kind of divide the two sides of the aisle. And I really agree with you. It's not really about labeling, but it does help to have some general categories. Right. And on the side of the aisle that you're describing, it's more, you know, kind of government's evil and ineffective and bad. You know, on that side, there's been some just remarkably consistent messaging for years on that very message. And that tends to, I mean, the stakeholders of that message, by and large, are folks who will buy in to a model of leadership in their life outside of politics, mm-hmm. of either a preacher in a pulpit or a CEO in front of a corporation, right, or a military general. I mean, they're used to kind of standing in line with right. a cause around a message. Now, the folks on the other side of the aisle who line up, as you're describing, right, I mean, they're going to esteem more like this very conversation, right? The model is the university professor for whom we all have nuanced conversation. Mm-hmm. Right, or the facilitator of a dialogue. Now, all that's lovely. I mean, I'm a huge fan. My life is invested in that very model. However, it doesn't make for good movement building. Right. And so when you get to critiquing the very kinds of questions you're raising, it is on the other side of the aisle, unfortunately, I mean, the very thing that is a great strength, which is kind of critical thinking and dialogue and respect and working it out, doesn't unite critical mass around, you know, a particular issue. So that's a really big one. And I want to get one step further, actually, and say that, so then you have these messages that you set up, and so let's just say they're really simple. It has something to do with freedom, and it's a particular definition of freedom. It has something to do with guns, it's a particular definition around guns. It has something to do with choice or, you know, other words for that. You get about 3, 4, 5 key value messages. And there's this base, kind of a pyramid, around those messages. You can kind of lop off. The top of that pyramid is your candidate du jour, right? That could have been George W. Bush 8 years ago, a variety of people before that. And, you know, if they don't live up, if, like, Quayle doesn't live up to that expectation for one reason, you lob them off and replace them with somebody else. But you still have the same, no new taxes, right. none of this, none of that.
The same repeated
right, thing. Right,
yeah.
Same repeated thing. Now, over on this side, the same issue that I was saying about kind of critical thinking and nuance and all that, well, we rebuild a candidate, right, for every particular office every 4 years or 2 years or 6 years, and that person has to go through thorough, you know, deep levels of vetting by all of us on all of these nuances. And we don't just replace folks around simple 6 messages, mm-hmm. right? We're rebuilding, redefining, re-whatever. And so there are matters of efficiency and leverage and unity in a movement, unfortunately, that the very thing that strengthens us so much, I mean, really works against us in terms of how the politics
right.
of the day work.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I'm working on, I have a bill on universal health care. And it's interesting how the groups that back it are kind of fighting with each other all the time, because it's, whether it's ego or whether it's actual philosophy of something, there's a big fight over it, and then you also have nuanced things about, well, is this good enough, is this the right way, and you have the, is it realistic or not realistic, so we have all those fights, and you're right, it's a good observation. I'm not sure that there's an easy answer.
No, there's not at all.
Because again, the more simple-minded approach, just all you have to focus, repeat after me, no new taxes. that's a pretty simple one, and saying, well, you know, maybe we would be willing to spend money for this purpose. But the one thing I would add to it, though, and the one I want to get back to in a minute, is that we really don't have anybody pointing out where we should be going. It's been so chaotic, there's nobody really giving a message other than, well, you know, we'd really like to do this. And candidates on that side have been kind of, well, we want to do a little more of this. I think back to 1984, Walter Mondale running against Ronald Reagan. And I would characterize what his campaign was about was, well, I want to cut spending too, but not as much as Reagan. I want to spend more on defense, but not as much as Reagan.
Right.
And I want to cut welfare too, but not as much as Reagan. Well, you know, if you want to cut welfare, spend more on defense, and cut taxes kind of thing, you're going to vote for the real thing.
Right.
Maybe. You had one thing before we move on.
It's pretty much been covered, so that's fine.
Oh, okay.
Can I just ask just one question? As an outsider, I'm an American citizen, so don't tell me to go home. But I would like to ask you, as an American citizen from birth, and as a guy on the inside of politics, why it is that when the World Health Organization rates the healthcare system in this country as number 37, which is a remarkable achievement. You really got to work to get that. Why is it that when all of the evidence is against it, we still have to listen to these mantras of this is the greatest country in the world, everything here is the best healthcare system in the world, and the American voter continues to go along with this in the context of this long, ludicrous primary season and so forth? Why does it have to be that way? Why can we not get down to brass tacks by cutting the election season down to 5 weeks as in normal countries?
We actually talked about that yesterday when I was talking about special interest money. And constitutionally, we cannot limit the amount of time people are running ads and that sort of thing. We can make sure the election season is as compact as possible. Minnesota, our non-presidential, our legislative, state, congressional, U.S. Senate races, our primary for them is in mid-September, 8 weeks before the general election. There's some people, both political parties, want to move it till June. A lot of media people want to move it to June. A lot of the media wants to move it to June. A lot of big contributors want to move it to June, because then we'll have more time for the public to have a thoughtful discussion between the philosophies rather than nitpicking between different members of the same party. And my point to that is, what all that's going to do is mean we're going to have 6 months instead of 2 months of inane TV commercials that don't inform. But part of what I want to talk about today is why we accept it the way we are, and that the arrogance that it's kind of like ancient Rome. They knew they were good, hot stuff, and in time they just crumbled because they were so self-confident about how great they were without doing anything to be great. Anyway, this has been helpful on a number of points on why we are this way. But what does it take to change? Well, I think it could be simplified by about two things. One is public has to be persuaded that change is possible, and they have to be sold on the benefits of change. Saying, what universal health care if people, well, you know, it's so expensive, I don't want to do this. If they are told, you know, here's what it means. We're going to have a healthier society. It's going to cost less because people get to the doctor when they need. I think that would be helpful. So it has to be sold that change is possible and is worth doing. And in order to do that, we need leadership. I think not just leadership in the political world, though we certainly need that. We need it from civic leaders. We need it from nonprofits and religious faith community people. We need it from media commentators, the experts that they use in the media to tell us what's going on. But politicians and faith community have a key role. Faith community's been speaking out a little bit about how it's not acceptable. They've been much more vocal in the last 3, 4, 5 years, recognizing that there was a big gap and getting tired of some, the Christian right, many people say, is neither Christian nor right. But But that's the voice that's been out there, and so people are, faith leaders have been speaking out more. But what we need is leaders in politics, in civic life, in faith community, that one will say the status quo is unacceptable and mean it, because they believe it's unacceptable to have people living in homeless shelters. Two, they're willing to stand up to the, what I would say is bipartisan defeatism. One party doesn't want anything to happen. The other party says, well, nothing real can happen anyway. We can tinker here, but we can't make real progress. So you have to stand up to both sides on it, and you have to have confidence in your ideas and the ability to move forward. You have to believe you can do something about poverty or healthcare or the environment or education if you want to move forward. Confidence that the ideas are good, that they're workable, and that you can pull things together and make it happen. Otherwise, you get defeatism of, it's just, there's no way we can get there. We have to build, know that we ourselves believe we can get there. Then you can get ahead. Next thing we have to do is not confuse rhetoric for vision. I think that too many times we have people, universal health care. Oh, yeah, I support universal health care. Yeah, I support a clean environment, clean lakes and rivers. And I support, every politician says that, both parties. Oh, yeah, I support that. Quality education. I mean, you can, every candidate has the same stuff in their ads and their literature. Don't confuse rhetoric for a vision. And I mentioned earlier how the Healthcare Access Commission, the people who put it together in our legislative commission, they set themselves a goal that was noble, but then they just ignored their own goal. And there's no penalty when the legislature doesn't do what it says it's supposed to. But we have to spell out a positive vision. Sell the public on the benefits of change. That sounds simple, but we're often told, here's the problem. I mean, Michael Moore had a great movie, Sicko, on the healthcare system. It was, I think it was a little bit too smooth on what it's like in other countries, but it was right about the problems with ours. And it's, most politicians can point out the problems as what's going wrong, but very few will go a step further and spell out what could be done, what we envision. My guess, and I'm not sure if this is the reason, there may be a thousand other reasons, that one of the reasons Barack Obama has had so much success, especially with young people, is he spells out, here's where we can go. Here's how we can make progress forward. You look at the race speech that he's done, he's did one on patriotism the other day. You spell out not just what the problem, what's caused our racism, which he's articulate about that, but also here's the way we can build a society in the future. And he's actually bringing together people of both parties. Republicans say they really believe him. They really like him. They think he's not playing games. He's not just hollow rhetoric. So the opposition, both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, have been, oh, it's just hollow rhetoric. But people seem to sense there's something more than hollow rhetoric there, so that might be what happens. And in terms of persuading public that success is possible, I think that can be simple to do too if the leaders themselves believe it, but many of them don't. And it's simple because the public wants to believe. They want to have hope in a better future. They want to be inspired. That's why we look back and have so many people talk about Martin Luther King. I mean, we name a day after how, what a bold visionary he was, and Bobby Kennedy, what a bold visionary he was. We're looking back 40 years now to say, wow, what inspired leadership there is. Why do we look back 40 years? Because it's been kind of hollow in between. There's not been a lot to replace it. So we look back and say we need this hope. What's his name? Rabbi Michael Werner, who's formed this group, Tikkun, not sure how, T-I-K-K-U-N, magazine. His number one theme is the issue of political realism. We've got to stop talking about political realism because that's how they kill off anything. Just say it's not realistic. If an idea is good, oh, it's not realistic. We could never get that. So we just give up before we've even tried. When you look at previous motion efforts, you look at anti-slavery movement, abolition, you look at civil rights movement, you look at women's suffrage, you look at retirement security, social security, all of those are politically unrealistic. Absolutely no way women are going to have the right to vote. They can't vote. How can they get the power to vote from people who are going to lose power to them? Civil rights, how are we ever going to do that? There's hatred there. But a bunch of people, some political leaders, some religious leaders, and the public at large decided, we're just going to do it anyway. I mean, they really believed in it, and they fought for it, and it became realistic. And Rabbi Werner talks about how much we use that to defeat ourselves by saying, it's not realistic. And so what you have to do is just get past it. Forget the phrase political reality. When I'm trying to steer this poverty commission that I serve on, it's actually got a great name, this commission. It's the Commission to End Poverty in Minnesota by 2020. And the commission that came out of the Lutheran Synod in St. Paul and suggested we ought to be more bold and visionary in what we do. So the legislature created a commission, and first thing everybody does is talk about how it's not even commission members. Well, yeah, I'm glad to, because we could do something about poverty. No, we could never end poverty, could never do this, never do that, but, you know, I'm glad to help out. Well, that's, if the members of the commission start with that premise, you're not going to get anywhere. And so I've been suggesting that they take off their political lenses, their ideological lenses, their political reality lenses, saying, well, with this governor and this legislature, nothing's going to happen. Well, yes, forget about that. We've got 12 years to do this. Let's make recommendations. We have to make the recommendations this year. But let's forget about what we see as politically realistic. Map out where you want to go. There's no way in the world 20 legislators on a commission, half Democrats, half Republicans, you couldn't get three of them to agree on a route to take that would really end poverty. And I think there are routes you could do. I could spell out some, but I wouldn't have three members of the commission voting along with it. So what I'm telling them is take off your lenses about the ideology, against about your political realities, about everything else. We're not being asked to pass something because we can't. We're 20 people. We're not the legislature. But let's do what we're supposed to do. Make recommendations on how we can end poverty. Think of yourself as a map maker. You're there to map the route or routes. If you want multiple routes on how we can end poverty. And then put that together, even if you wouldn't vote in the legislature to take that route. Let's just vote to put it together, because then you're spelling out the vision, and then advocacy groups, and if we say, you know, we really do want to do it, maybe that's worth doing. The first step is to lay out the vision and how you can get there and then move from there. Yeah?
Does it make sense in the context you're speaking now for a wide range of people in this election period to take hold of the goal, no child left behind, and work it positively in terms of what it really would take
to make it. So
to make it, because obviously it is an idea that, you know, came from an interesting source in the political spectrum, and I think had a lot of support in terms of a simple goal that people said, well, yeah, that's right. To do it will take a lot of tax money and a lot of imagination and a lot of wrestling around the role of teachers and you know, all that. But from your perspective, does it make sense to take hold of that and let's work with that? Because I know there are some progressives who, you know, no, and it's partly the source and partly the way it was done, but
yeah. Well, I think that's one of the difficulties, and it's a political strategy question.
Yes,
take the wording that they kidnapped.
I understand.
And because if you can overwhelm it and let people know, you know, no child left behind, some group came in with cut a school bus in half, and they said, they showed the rear end of the bus. This is No Child Left Behind. They really are left behind.
Yeah.
No Child Left Behind did leave more people behind. And the administration had a clear skies proposal, which was actually allowing more air emissions from polluters. You look back, the Reagan years, we had a new missile, what was it called, a Peacekeeper?
Peacekeeper.
I mean, they even were going to name a ship, the USS Corpus Christi, the body of Christ, a warship. People objected to it, so they renamed it the city of Corpus Christi, which is presumably what they were thinking of. I'm not sure whether you take their words and take it back. Patriotism has become something that means you have to want to be spending more money on fighting wars with people instead of working to build trust and support from other nations. So it's a question whether you use that wording or not. But But again, back to it, I think we have to spell out the vision and say how we're going to get there. I use the example of violent crime. What are we doing for it? Will we lock up more people? We hire more cops? We build better security systems in our homes and businesses and so on? It's homeland security type of thing. And that's all important. If you've got dangerous people, you got to protect yourself against them. But what about spelling out a vision? We're going to cut crime by half. Not 10% as a mayor will say, hey, crime's gone down 10% in the last 3 years under my watch. But you know, we're going to cut crime by half. Is it because we never talk about that? Is that because we can't do it? I think we know how to do it. You look at dysfunctional kids who, you know, if kids are in dysfunctional homes, if they've got abuse at home, if there's drug use, those kids are going to end up in trouble. Kindergarten teachers can predict a lot of kids who are going to fail because we don't intervene. Earlier intervention, chemical dependency treatment, mental health services to people. We got a third of a million people, or 5 million people state in Minnesota, a third of a million people who need chemical dependency treatment, we don't get it. You know, what if we said we're going to spell out the vision, we're going to cut crime by half, how are we going to do it? We're going to do early intervention with troubled families, we're going to do CD chemical dependency assessments for everybody in trouble with the courts, we're going to then make sure they get into treatment, we're going to do mental health services for people. You do like five or six simple things like that, they're not easy and they're very expensive to do, but you could actually cut crime and cut crime by half. Three quarters of the people in our prisons are people who committed their violent, they're almost always violent offenses, unless they are drug offenses. They're almost always violent and they commit their offense under the influence of alcohol or some other drug. 9/10 of domestic murders are under the influence. And California studies said every dollar you spend on CD treatment, you save $7 to taxpayers. It saves money to do it. Why don't we spell out the vision and do this? People accept that. I think people are eager to have leadership. They're eager to see a vision. They're willing to follow. They want to have hope. And so the simple solution to the defeatism is to get, recognizing we got what you pointed out about the fact we're kind of dissonant people. Progressive people want to think things through and want to fight. We all got our own little angle on it. But we have to, nevertheless, as a community, as leaders in the community, we have to spell out a vision. We have to get rid of this notion that things are politically unrealistic and move ahead boldly anyway, because that's the way you make them become that way. And going back to Robert Kennedy, he used to quote George Bernard Shaw every time. It was slightly different, but basically the quote was, some people look at things the way they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not. That's a very simple explanation of what a vision is that we seem to have lost. And when one side of the political spectrum doesn't care about that, the other side is just sitting there silently. And so I think that that's the way we rebuild the hope and rebuild the vision. But for 30 or 40 years now, we've lost it. And I'm arguing it's time to take it back. With that, yeah, I'll open it up. We got a few minutes for it.
Are you familiar with Jim Wallace and Sojourners and his recent book, The Great Awakening? And, you know,
I haven't read his
book. That book to you. He is a modern day prophet. When you talk about the 40-year gap between Kennedy and King and now, Wallace is a today prophet. And in the book, The Great Awakening, he addresses about 8 or 10 of these crucial issues and why we need to solve them and some small efforts here and there that are underway.
They're happening. Yeah.
That are happening to give hope that maybe someday, if we do work at it long enough, we'll solve them. But I commend that book to you. It's a wonderful
book. If people want the Sojourners, the magazine and the community that he pushes is Sojo, SOJO.com?
.org.
Sojo.org. Anyway, but they've got lots of good. He and a number of religious leaders.
Yes.
Tony Campolo, who's these are more conservative theologically.
He's a former Baptist minister.
Yeah. You know? Tony Campolo, he gives a speech. I mean, and he knows when you're talking about how to spell things out in the right way. He's done a speech many times that he says, you know, it angers the shit out of me that 30,000 kids are dying every day from hunger in this world. And then he says, And it bothers me, it bugs me even more that you're bothered more that I said the word shit in terms of when you hear that, you think, wow.
Yeah.
It immediately puts things in perspective. But yeah, there's some religious leaders who've been doing that. Mainstream, not the more conservative Christian movement, but mainstream Protestants and Catholics, Jews, some Islamic community in more recent years have been speaking out on those issues. So there is some leadership there, but it's been pretty quiet, relatively speaking.
Can you comment, I mean, I think especially in your unique position, another card that gets played in this whole game is kind of the shift of jurisdiction. So you get really close to some solution at the federal level. It's like, oh, you know, we got to leave that up to the states.
Yeah.
Oh, we wouldn't want to meddle in the states. And you just know it's bogus, right? I mean, occasionally, there are viable times when you say, well, of course, you know, but there are many times, you know, it's so bogus, and it's like, okay, you're just dispelling this in 50-plus different directions. Like, oh, well, yeah, we wouldn't want to meddle. When it really is, we don't want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to send it right back, and we're going to send this solution that's been working for 2 decades up this, we're going to send it right back down. I mean, you're in a unique position.
That happens all the time.
In both ways, too.
Yeah, yeah. It does.
And the people who say, we want local control, you know, when it's in there, oh, no, we want to have the state ban local governments from doing what they want to do. We're going to have to do it our way. And same thing with the federal government versus the state. It's a real problem. I'll give one example that I carried when I first was elected 22 years ago. I was a co-author of a bill to require all cigarettes be fire-resistant. Fire-resistant that they self-extinguish. You light them up. Tobacco itself does not burn very well. If you're not puffing on it, it extinguishes. So they actually put accelerants in it over time. They figured ways to package it so it keeps burning. And the cigarette industry presumably likes it that way because they take a couple of puffs, set it down, and it smolders so there's nothing left. The industry said it was not feasible to deal with, not anything else. There are in Minnesota, this is dwarfed by the number of people who died of cancer and stuff related to cigarettes, but there are about 15 to 20 people in Minnesota who died every year from fires started by careless smoking. In other words, somebody fell asleep, cigarette hit it, fell on the couch, and kindergarten kid died. Terrible tragedy. An 8-year-old, I remember these stories over the years. Anyhow, I pushed that, took over as chief author of that about 20 years ago when the other guy retired, and then been pushing it ever since. We finally passed that last year, and tobacco industry basically gave up at that time, but they have been able to kill it off 20 years times, if you figure 15 lives a year, that's 300 people died painful deaths because of it, something that was easily fixable, and every year, oh, this has to be done at the national level, and at the national level, oh, the states should be dealing with it, they use it both sides, and the simple response is, just say, look, I mean, with the health care, I've got this bill that would provide health care to every Minnesotan for all their medical needs. Got a third of our legislature co-authoring it. We're building support for it. As soon as we get enough that we're really on the radar where we actually have a chance to do it, you can be sure. Well, this is really good, but, you know, we ought to do it at the federal level. My response is simply, yeah, we ought to do it at the federal level, but they're not doing it, so we're going to do it. So,
happens a lot of issues that the states and even cities are kind of starting to develop their own policies on issues that really
are national issues.
Things would be national issues. You know, things as diverse as immigration
environmental
stuff. Those are two things that really come to mind because the federal, there's been no federal leadership.
Mm-hmm. And,
different states are trying different things.
Right.
And I
think you're right. That's where a lot of creativity is coming. It's a lot easier to make change at the local level. Granted, a resolution by a city council on some international foreign policy issue is not going to have the same impact as if the president and Congress did something about it.
Yeah.
But it's nevertheless beginning to say, here's the way things could be. So I really think the more try it, whatever level you can get, even if it's a token thing, it's still a step in the right direction, should be pushed. A couple more things. Anything else? Yeah.
Back to your statement regarding the reduction of crime. One of the reactive approaches to build more prisons, keep locking people up. Then you have, well, let's do it in a proactive manner.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start when the so-called potential criminals are infants.
Right.
Now, this is going to, this may take 20 years. So you've got a, we've got a mentality in the, in government, as well, possibly in government, but I know in business, that you, you're focusing on the next quarterly report. And then as soon as the CEO gets a good one, he may by his actions, he may have sabotaged things for the next poor schmuck that takes his job. But he retires with a real nice pension and leaves the problems to someone else.
Yeah, that's very much, in politics, it's probably more likely the next election.
Yeah.
Statesman is somebody who looks at something the next election. I mean, 2 years is not a very long cycle, and a lot of things don't pay back for 10, 15 years. When our current governor first was elected, he had a big budget deficit, and he had committee chairs come over to his house for a breakfast meeting one day, and I told him how I thought his budget proposal was going to do a lot of harm, because he was not going to cut prisons because we couldn't afford to. We're expanding them. But after-school programs for troubled kids, other efforts to reduce it, those are the things we're going to slash and burn because we don't have the money to do it. I said, that doesn't make much sense. Sometimes those programs save several dollars for every dollar we invest.
Yeah.
John, I understand that. I know fully. Sometimes you spend save $3 or even $4 or $5 for every dollar you spend on it. But what you don't understand is we don't have the $1.
So you got
great the policy here. You don't have $1 now, so we're going to find $4 in the future. He said that. I mean, he believed it in his mind somehow that made sense. and we do things very short-sightedly. And I couldn't agree more that we have to look at the long term of things, and we got to just say that the long term matters.
But we have $500 million for a baseball stadium.
Right. One last one.
Yeah, well, again, I'm very sorry. I apologize.
No, you have every right to speak.
In terms of what could be really contributing as underlying causes to so much of this nonsense, you know, which continues, and then what has been mentioned so far is just a small drop in the bucket of the nonsense that we have tolerated all the time, is not the real tragedy that the American electorate, unfortunately, are very ill-informed compared to their contemporaries in other countries, and the real reason for this, tragically, as some people have suggested, is that news has become entertainment, and that the primary season and elections themselves have become entertainment and not vehicles for serious discussion.
Yes, that's very true. The media and the conservative right has gone on saying how it's that liberal media that's corrupting us all. I mean, in effect, you accuse your opponent, you run a slimy campaign, but before you start accusing your opponent of being slimy. And then you do it, and then it takes some of the stuff off of you. They've been very effective about that. You look at how many issues the media won't touch. I mean, why can't we get campaign finance reform? The media has not been helpful in that. They benefit from all the ads.
Oh, yeah.
They clearly benefit from the ads. They do not, on an issue about giving away the new digital airwaves 5, 7, 8 years ago. Bob Dole and actually John McCain, this is 10 years ago, actually were involved in trying to expose that. That we wanted, that our government was giving away the broadcast spectrum to television networks. And why don't we sell it? It's worth billions of dollars. And there wasn't a single story on any of the network news channels, not a single story on it. And there was very little in the papers, too, which there's a lot of cross-ownership there, which is a problem. But there was almost nothing. That there was one story on public radio that talked about it, but otherwise you wouldn't know that we were giving, government was making an $80 billion, I think it was, giveaway. Media is corrupted by this. They have very strong conflict of interest, and as you said, they kind of, people in power who like the way things are would rather talk about, oh, the stories, we spent all our time on the weather, or a cat in the tree, or some murder, or something like that, but nothing about public policy. You can learn more about our public policy here by listening to BBC and international programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's very helpful. I hope this was interesting and helpful to you. I'll take one. We'll cut it off here. I'll be happy to stay around and.